Tape 4, Side 1, Continuing Interview of Bell Shapiro, National Council's Oral History Program. There was another subject which I considered a problem with the American Jewish Committee, because as a human rights organization whose longevity goes a way, way back, I didn't think that they were really dealing with the problem with women's rights. When I came into the first meeting I was planning, first annual meeting, we had a male chairman and we had a female co-chairman. Her name was Judy Grauer, well known in Pittsburgh, but that has nothing to do with it, because I found out that the co-chairman not only has nothing to say at the meeting, but sits, does not even sit on the dais. Well, I'm not going to go into it. We rectified all that. And from that time on, every co-chairman was involved in the program. As a matter of fact, since then, there have been several women chairmen altogether. And every time anyone tells me about this and may not remember my involvement with it, I kind of smile to myself. It really makes me feel good. But in my last days with the American Jewish Committee, I began to get calls from someone whose name was Baruch Lilo. He was the head of the Philadelphia office for El Al Israel Airlines. And I had met Mr. Lilo once or twice before, I don't recall which. And the gist of the whole thing was that he had talked to people in Pittsburgh, and for the first time, I don't think any of the other airlines except one ever had a woman who was a representative. He was looking for a woman representative. I have a feeling that they felt they could get a better woman at a given salary than they could a man, because in Pittsburgh, I remember that many of the representatives of the airlines were, well, where would you find? They were all men, except for the one woman. And you'd find them in bars and all kinds of places, whereas women take it more seriously. At any rate, it so happened that the same name kept coming up all the time, and so I became, with many, many feelings of trepidation and a lot of nervousness, I became the first lady El Al representative. I remember something Baruch Lilo said to me in the very early days. This was October the 1st, 1966. That's when I started with El Al. Baruch said to me one day, you know, you are going to have a few successes, many failures, you will have sleepless nights, you will love and you will hate your job, but I'll promise you one thing, you will never be bored. And my friend Baruch was right on. The entire summation, because that's the way it was. To begin with, the only person in Pittsburgh whom I knew who had flown on El Al Israel Airlines, the airline of the people of Israel, was Meyer Mintz, whom you may remember. The only one. Meyer was then the head of the, what is it now, the, you remember what it was, Mildred?
The United Jewish Federation of the Tri-State Area.
United Jewish Appeal, that's what it was for the tri-state area. I've almost forgotten, how could I? But at any rate, this was the only contact I had. The United Jewish Federation here in Pittsburgh, most of them when they had their yearly and semi-annual trips to Israel, would go on either Air France or TWA. And I remember the hard time I had selling our own on the fact that love for Israel is best described and best exemplified by the use of its own carrier. First of all, we realized, and these were the early days before the 747, this started October 66. It was a very difficult time. Convincing people to go to Israel was one problem that was difficult. Convincing them to go on El Al was another problem. But not to belabor the fact, over the years, I think we were highly successful. We started out with a couple of groups from synagogues. I remember Tree of Life Rabbi Kaplan I'll never forget his anger with something, which I think is worthy of remembering. He was going, taking a group the first time to Israel, and he couldn't get the flight that the agent involved thought we should get. And so the agent placed them on TWA. And I remember that Rabbi Kaplan called me on the phone. And first he gave me a sample of his anger. And how dare anyone decide for me? If we are not going Yalal, that defeats my purpose. And we will cancel. Well, to get them back on this 1 a.m. flight from here, from New York, which made a stop or whatever, was almost impossible because El Al was fully booked at the time, even on the 727, which was a much smaller plane. We finally got them on. And I remember I tried to get a hold of Rabbi Kaplan, and he was speaking to a group at Webster Hall. It was a B'nai B'rith group. And I came down there, and he was on the platform at the time, and I sent him up a note which said, "This is your friendly El Al Israel Airlines neighbor representative. We did it." And he smiled on, right on the platform there, and he told the whole group what the argument was about and how you have to stick to your guns and how you have to support Israel. I shall never forget that, and I shall always be grateful to his memory. Well, that was one of the things that happened. Selling El Al was never an easy thing. It was as hard to sell our own people as it was, I found, to sell the Christian element. And I had many Christian groups, and it was very interesting, some of the things that happened during those times. I remember that the first group I sold was to a minister in Beaver Falls, and we became very good friends. He was taking a group of other ministers from all over the tri-state area. And as soon as he came back, I couldn't wait to call him naturally. I said, "How was it? How was it?" And he said, "Remember Reverend so-and-so?" He was a young black minister from Clareton. After the third day, he said, "You know, if it ends tomorrow, the trip, I wouldn't mind." And I said, "Well, what happened?" I thought, surely something awful happened. He said, "Well, after what I've seen, it doesn't matter if I die tomorrow. I have lived these 3 days as I never hoped to." Something that happened a little later on, I think, is worthy of repeating. I don't remember exactly when it was, but in my office, I had a call one day from a priest in Clareton. And he said, "Mrs. Shapiro, you know, a couple people have told me to call you and tell you about this incident." Now, to back up and give you a little history on how it happened, you know, we used to have a saying that we never fly on Friday nights, but every Friday night we fly too, but anyway. What happens was that other airlines, something goes wrong with a plane and whatnot, and so they take our plane. It's kind of a rental thing. It has other names, but regardless. So this was a Friday night, and there were a group of pilgrims going to Rome for Easter. And this priest said that they were flying on El Al because Alitalia didn't have a plane available. So when they got on the El Al plane this Friday night, the captain announced, "Ladies and gentlemen, tonight is the first night of our Passover. We hope you don't mind being served a typical Passover meal because that's what we have for you. We hope you don't mind that the crew and I will be reciting our Haggadah. However, if some of you want to join in, we'll be very glad to make books available for you." So the priest said, "You have no idea what happened." First of all, most priests do know Hebrew anyway, and if they don't, there were two priests involved, were able to explain, and all the way over to Rome, they had their Passover Seder with everybody involved, all these Christian pilgrims taking part in it, and they sang Haggadah clear across the ocean. Then when they arrived in Rome at Fiumicino Airport, the people from St. Peter's who were to meet this large group weren't there yet. So the entire LL crew sat with the priest and the pilgrims, and they sang the Haggadah until St. Peter's arrived. And to me, that was one of the, well, it was one of the sweet things that happened. I mean, we had plenty of unpleasant ones, but I think I really got more out of, I hate to use the word converting, but getting to see some of our own Jewish people, what it was like to go to Israel, and especially on Elul. I'll never forget a small group I had, and among them was Mrs. Stark, Sydney's, and, you know, that family, yes, mother. Well, that's her mother-in-law. Yes. She was in this small group, and I, you know, every representative or every worker does things in his or her own way. And I used to make it a habit that whether my flight from Pittsburgh arrived, I used to accompany the groups to New York at any time. Whether it arrived at LaGuardia or at the other one, it didn't make any difference, because eventually we came to the Kennedy Airport, and the LL plane used to be sitting out there under protection at all times. And I always stopped and said, now there is your plane. And I'll never forget Mrs. Stark. She looked at it and she said, imagine we even have airplanes. Now, you know, you can call it a silly remark, but to me, that sums up. That sums up the belief and the times that people began to see this and take it seriously and become Israel-oriented, and I couldn't have been happier. There were many incidents of this kind. There was a little gentleman I'll never forget. Wherever he is, I hope he's well and strong. It was the last time I went to Israel with my husband, may he rest in peace. And you know, this was already with the 747s, I'm skipping all over the place. There is a contraption, a bus with stilts. It's called the Plane Mate, and it meets the yellow passenger group at the entrance to the plane. It goes up and down, and it ferries out to the 747. It takes about 4.5 minutes, 5 minutes to get out there. It's got about 80 seats on it, so there's usually two or three groups that go over. And it's got benches and, you know, like the straps that we have on the street, had on the streetcars for so many years here. And you stand, some people stand, some sit, depends. This little gentleman, this elderly little gentleman, was standing in front of us, hanging on to the strap. And I hear him saying, and not complaining, but saying, I was hoping that when I went to Israel, I would get a seat on the airplane. He did not realize that this wasn't the plane. He'd probably never flown before. I didn't ever get to talk to him. I didn't want to spoil a moment for myself. So, I mean, occasionally one runs into it. The Israeli sense of humor is a peculiar thing, and there are many incidents, but I'm only going to give you one. When my husband and I were leaving Tel Aviv, we were waiting to get on the flight. We were all checked in and whatnot. And just before boarding the plane, there were a couple of tables where people were having coffee and a schnecken or whatever. And there were, in this one table, there were a group of them in uniform. So my husband goes over to one and he said, hey, are you the captain? And the captain salutes. He says, present, sir, what can I do for you? He says, I want you to drive very carefully. So the captain says, you have no idea that tonight I will be specially careful. He says, well, why tonight will you be specially careful? He says, because tonight my wife's husband is on board. That's part of the Israel sense of humor. I remember when Fred Remington went over. Do you remember that, Mildred? He was sent over by WTAE, and this whole group came back. Some of them wanted to move lock, stock, and barrel there. And I took them to New York, the whole crew. And Fred said, do you have any last-minute words for me, any last-minute feeling of some kind. He said, so that I can feel comfortable. I said, I don't know if it's going to make you feel comfortable. I said, but there's one thing you must know about the Israeli. If you come to them with any kind of thing you want solved, whatever it is, they will say to you, no problem. And then they'll go on, do something else. But you have to keep pushing, because that's the way it happens. Well, when they got back from the trip, I opened up the Post-Gazette one day, and there's this story with a big heading, no problem. Now, you have to understand that the writer of a story in the newspaper, I imagine still the same, does not set the heading. It's the editor. But even he got the story, because Fred had written a number of things about the Israelis and the guides and whatnot. He says one day they were looking over into Jordan, and they could see soldiers over there. This is some time ago, of course, with guns. And he said to the guide, he said, you know, they have guns over there. And the guide said to him, no problem, don't worry. And Fred said, well, the guide knows it's no problem. I hope they know it's no problem. But that kind of thing happened frequently. There were many kinds of trips we started that the rest of the world has continued since then. One was the family trip, an idea I had while I was very active with the YIKC. I was on their board, and since I was the representative for El Al, nobody there would dare go any other way. You know that. There was Arthur Rothman, who was most helpful, and he was the executive director there. He is now... I think he's the executive secretary of the Jewish Welfare Board. The first idea of a family group to Israel, people found it imaginative. They were interested in it, and the first one filled up quickly. Now I had as my champion, he didn't go on that trip, but he was, guess who helped me the most? He loved the idea. Naturally, Herman Feinberg, who else? He just love the idea. Now, something happened during that time. If you would remember, there was a time when marijuana and all drugs were prevalent almost everywhere. And Arthur and I talked it over, and although this trip wasn't leaving until during the time of the Christmas holidays when the kids were home, over Thanksgiving most of them were home, and we had a large meeting at the Y of the children and the parents. And I pulled no punches. I told them all what they could expect if they were going to succumb to the Arab selling marijuana, selling dope, selling any kind of drugs. And they all seemed to understand. When I took them to the airport finally, again, we talked it over. Despite all that, came the day for them to return. And I knew something was wrong because I hadn't heard from anyone. Finally got a call from New York that this flight was going to be delayed. I don't remember how many hours, but many hours. And I called all the parents involved that were not, I mean, families that were going to go out and meet the parents and their children. And one of our children here in Pittsburgh, with no point saying who, had been found at the airport. Now remember, the guide had said to them, if any of you have anything, give it to me. They didn't. So an Arab came in with a policeman, pointed out one boy, and of course he was arrested and thrown into jail. Subsequently, he was there a number of times with his father. I mean, he stayed there for a long time with his father. They were able to get free, but it never happened again on El Al. And I know it was one of the things that was very rough for all of us to take. But these things happen, and you have to be alert and aware at all times. I'm going to skip from there. Well, first let me go back to something which I thought was funny. This minister I had in Beaver Falls, it's a lovely church, a Presbyterian church. He was taking a group of his parishioners to Israel. It was the first time. And he was describing to them what would happen. They would walk in the footsteps of Christ. They would see the places where he lived. They would, all the things that the Christian tours held. We always called those the Holy Land tours. And then he came to introduce me to discuss the trip with the people. He looked at me and he said, "Belle, I hope I haven't offended you, you know, with all the talk of Christ." I said, "No, you haven't offended me, but you've forgotten a very important part of history." He was one of our boys first. Well, it broke up the group. We had so much fun over that, and I mean, they never forgot it when they came back from the trip. They talked about history again. These things are pleasant to remember. It was part of what made the job palatable, because it was a rough one. Then there were the immortal and memorable days of the Six-Day War. And I remember when it broke out, I had said to Baruch Lilo, "Baruch, I will do anything you want. I don't want to be paid. If you don't need me, if you need me, whatever you want, I will do," because we were all very much involved. I mean, if you remember those days. And here I am working for the Israel Airline. And Baruch said, "No, I want you to stay where you are, because this will be over shortly. Take my word for it." He said, "And then I will really need you." Okay. One day, this was around the third or the fourth day after the Six-Day War started, I come in my office, and my not-too-bright secretary reporter, memorabilia take or whatever, said to me, even knew that the call was strange. She says, "I have a very unusual telephone call from you. It's a Mr. McCormick, and he wants information on sending cargo to Cairo." This is a firm in Pittsburgh, which should remain nameless. I said, "Are you sure?" She says, "Positive. Here is the Six-Day War with David and Goliath being talked about all over the place. You know, you couldn't pick up a newspaper, you couldn't hear a broadcast without hearing the wonder of the Israelis, of all the Davids. And this man is calling me to get information on sending cargo to Cairo." So I called Mr. McCormick and I told him who I was. And I said to him, "You weren't pulling my leg, were you?" And he said, "Don't you fly to Cairo?" And I said, I'll never forget it. I said, "Not at the moment, but one day we will." So I said, "Tell me something. How did you get to me in the first place?" Well, he looked in the phone book and there was no Egyptian airline, and he looked on the map, and sure enough, Israel is next to Egypt. So what's more obvious? Who reads the newspapers? Who cares, you know? So I laughed and I said, "Do you mind my asking you what's in the cargo?" He says, "It would make a difference." I said, "Maybe. If you have a couple of guns or tanks, we'll take them and drop them off in Tel Aviv." And I thought he'd wake up, and all I met was silence. And I finally said to him, "Mr. McCormick, don't you ever read the newspapers?" And there's a long silence, and then he says, "Oh, good Lord, you must think I'm a real dumb Irishman." I said, "You said it, I didn't, but call TWA. Well, 10 years later, I'm still with El Al. And that was the day that Begin, yes, I always say Ben-Gurion, that Begin arrived in Cairo on El Al following Sadat's trip, if you remember. So, and it was in November, I remember, and I called Mr. McCormick. Well, the company had moved to larger quarters at that time. And when I finally got hold of him, I told him who I was, and I said, "I haven't talked to you for 10 years, but I promised you something." And then he remembered, and he said, "You'll never know the ribbing I took in the office for that." I said, "I told you that at that moment we were not flying to Cairo, but one day we would. And today El Al landed in Cairo carrying Mr. Begin." And he said, "Really?" I said, "Yep. But to show you he still doesn't read the newspapers," he said, "send me your schedule. We'll start shipments at once." So, I mean, so many of these things. I could go on and on about the things that happened with El Al, the history behind it, As for instance, there was a time, and I don't recall now when it was, and even in those days, in the old days, on the way over and on the way back too, there were not that many nonstop flights. Very often we would stop, we always stopped, I think it was 5 times a week in London. We would stop in Frankfurt, believe it or not, and that was awfully hard for me to take because it just was rough. I couldn't accept it. We stopped in Paris, sometimes in some of the Scandinavian countries. There was a schedule for all of this. I remember one time I had gone on what we called an interline tour of airlines personnel. We were invited on a tour. This time we went to Yugoslavia. And on the way back, we stopped in Frankfurt. And it was Tuesday, and I knew at a certain time on Tuesday, El Al would be stopping there. So while we were waiting for the plane to pick us up, the German plane to pick us up to take us to the States, I kept looking out. Now, this was mostly a Catholic group I was with. There are a few Protestants, but I think I was the only Jewish person on that particular group trip. They were all representatives of airlines, so that was easy to understand. And I went over there looking, and I hear this one Catholic girl with whom I'd become very friendly. She said to her husband, "Will you take a look at Bill? Any moment now, she's going to genuflect." I didn't, and they all came in, but you know, I still could not really and truly accept it. I had many visits to Israel. I had taken travel agents over. There were many things about the Arabs, about the Israelis, that piqued my curiosity and my fancy. And I always felt that we were getting somewhere. I mean, this was not just a job, but it never was with me. And I remember the time when I took this group of agents over there, and they were, well, they simply couldn't understand Israel and how you were able to enjoy yourself despite what you might read there, because Israel does that. Somehow or other, there is that feeling. When you're there, you feel protected. I know I used to go out at 9 o'clock in the night and walk towards the old city, and it would never give me a thought. Here, I wouldn't think of doing that. But that's the way it was in those days. I remember the things that people used to ask me before they went on a trip. What shall I take with me? What shouldn't I take? Weather, this, that, the other thing. And I remember, it may be cliche, but it was true. I said, in the first place, anywhere you go, anywhere in the world, don't go without your sense of humor, because, boy, you do need it. But if you're going to Israel, don't expect Naomi and Moses and Aaron and Ruth to be walking the streets. It is a country like any other. We are a people like any other, and we are entitled to our thieves and our good people, our saints, and all the others like any other country. But I do tell you, you will find less of that in Israel than you will find anywhere else. I remember a story that floated around in Israel many years ago that I still like to tell because it is, I think it's indicative of the way children are raised and of the way people in Israel think. This is a story about a young man whose bar mitzvah was being celebrated, and whose parents were a little more affluent than most of them, I suppose, and they were taking him for a trip on the continent as his gift. So they first arrived in Rome, and there he saw the people in the black with the hat like the very religious wear in Israel, and all in black, and he looked around and he said to his parents, "Are these people all Jewish?" And they said, "No, most of them are Christians." And he didn't say anything. Then they get to Paris, and again he sees people of all different kinds, and he asks, "Are most of these Jewish?" And the parents said, "No, most of them are Christians." And they get to London, same question, same answer, and some of the Scandinavian countries, same question, same answer, and he never says anything to his parents about it. But when he gets home, and he's talking to his hevra, his friends, and they asked him what it was like, and he said, "That's not the important thing. The important thing is the poor Christians. You have no idea how they're scattered throughout the world. There are many things, but perhaps there are some questions you might ask. I know you've been on LO. I don't know if both of you have. Mm-hmm. I think you may have some questions that pertain to that. So many things. I hate to go on and on and on with them.
Well, as you look back over your life, what do you view as your outstanding achievements or your failures?
Well, I guess one isn't always aware of failures in the same way in which you're aware of the things in which you find were successful or were meaningful. I always have to start in terms of meaningful. I have to start with my grandfather and what he implanted in my heart. And that is that I am completely and thoroughly Jewish. I think to me, the creation of Israel was easily the most important fact in my life because, you see, when you are privileged to witness something, you owe something. Because this generation of mine, in which so many others are involved, remember when there was no Israel, and it makes a big difference. My children, for instance, who are interested in Israel in their own way, but they don't remember a time when there wasn't any. Although, let me put it another way. I think the things that I find most thrilling, I'll give you an example. When she was 9.5 years old, I took my granddaughter on the trip to Israel on a regularly scheduled group tour. And look, people go younger, but I took her on a trip to Israel for learning purposes. And everyone thought I was crazy. And I said, well, it remains to be seen. We will see. I think of all the 18 trips I've made to Israel, that this was probably the most meaningful one of all. And I will just give you one little example of it. She had a great time. First of all, she was the only child among all these adults, and they spoiled her like crazy. And we were getting ready. Remember, it was a beautiful day in November. The sun was shining brightly. We were ready to go into Yad Vashem. And my daughter-in-law went in with the group, and I said to my granddaughter, Tracy, you and I'll stay out here and wait till they're out. And she turned around to me, and she said, Grandma, I know what that place is. It's about my people and what happened to my people, and I have a right, I have an obligation to know. And I almost fell over. But she walked in, and I followed her, and she read, and about 3/4 of the way through. And then she came out, and for a long time she said nothing. She just stared ahead, and she turned around and she said to me, Grandma, why did it happen? So I said, I can only quote someone by the name of Elie Wiesel, philosopher, one of our greatest poets. At that time he hadn't gotten the Nobel Peace Prize yet. And I said, and Elie Wiesel says that for the Holocaust, there are no answers, there are only questions. And then she asked me the big one. She said, but you don't think it can ever happen again, do you? I don't know what you would have said. But what came to me was something I really believe, that it depends on each and every one of us. Everything we do, which has a motive, and if we let it happen, it'll be as much our fault as anyone else's, because we know what can happen. It happened during our lifetime, and it better not ever happen again, but you have to be on the alert each and every time. And that was my introduction to reunion, or the prologue for tomorrow, because that's the way it was. Well, about Jewish life in Pittsburgh generally, I think I feel much better about it than I did during my own children's time. because somehow or other, people, being Jewish isn't hidden anymore. You don't walk around hiding it. Even the English language has some of our Yiddish expressions. I remember once my dentist, who was Yiddish speaking, and when I was there, of course, I didn't do much talking. My mouth was open. He talked. And he said, apparently you're not of that generation that hides the fact that it knows Yiddish. I see it everywhere. People who at one time didn't own up to the fact that they did. I see them now using expressions, asking me questions because they knew I speak Yiddish. And it's an entirely different kind of thing. What it will be for my grandchildren, I can't prophesy. But I am happier than I ever was about Jewish people. I still feel there's a lot that needs to be rectified. There's still not enough, but I'll never be satisfied or happy. It'll never be enough for me. I remember one time during the Sinai campaign, I was president of Hadassah at that time. When was that, 57? I think it was. 56, is that when? I don't remember exactly. When we marched into the Sinai and Israel was asked to back off. And then there were sanctions in the United Nations. And I walked into my mother's house and I was boiling. How dare they impose sanctions on Israel? Why didn't they let Israel finish the job and all that kind of thing? And my mother laughed and she said it in Yiddish, but I'll say it in English, little fool. Which is an endearing term where that's concerned, you know. Little fool, she said, just imagine that there is an Israel against whom sanctions can be imposed. That's the important thing. So part of it, I guess, was my mother and my grandfather and the kind of understanding that they had, which I inherited most lovingly. I really did. I loved every moment of it. I was always Jewish.
Are there any particular incidents with friends or associates that part of your life that are important that you feel that you want to comment on? I would add some information to this.
Well, I have to think about that because offhand I don't know. Sure, all the things that led to, for instance, how I came with the American Jewish Committee. This one man, I just know casually, but he had decided that I was the person for this. Despite the fact that in those days, the American Jewish Committee was anything but truly Zionist as it might be today. And I came from a completely Zionist background, which always left me wondering a little bit. But I think I added something of myself to the American Jewish Committee for the short time I was here, because I don't think you can, whether professionally or as a professional or as a volunteer, that you can be involved in a movement without adding your own feelings. That's, for instance, a meeting with all the rabbis. That's a good one as I can think of. But today it's entirely different. It's different. That would be one. Oh, there are many things, just too many to really remember. I know people whom I talked into going to Israel, to this day that we're good friends. I know people who go to Israel may not have a good trip, but just loved it. There is a woman I knew very well, who shall have to be nameless, and she never went to Israel. One time I kept asking her, how can you go everywhere else in the country? She said, I never go out of the country, never had a passport. And one day she called me while I was with El Al, and we are not the same good friends today, and I can understand it. And she said that the husband wanted them to go to Israel for their 25th wedding anniversary. I said, wonderful, wonderful. She says, let me ask you something. I have to apply for a passport. Do I have to tell my age on the passport? They were married 25 years, and her husband didn't know how old she was. And I said, honey, with Uncle Sam, you do not play. I do not play. I don't remember what she finally did. But we see each other on the street occasionally, she and her husband. And that's it. And every time I see them, I think about that. And I often wonder, did she ever, what did you do about a passport? Oh, people are funny, really, many, many things do happen. During my time with El Al, and this was at a time when all major airlines had offices here or representatives here, Sabena, Irish Air, British Airways, which still has something here, Air France, Lufthansa, I could go on and on and on. Everybody had representatives here. United Airlines. During that time, I think it was in the 70s, early 70s, all of the representatives of the various airlines were called out to the Pittsburgh airport, which was being so-called, quote-unquote, internationalized, which is, to me, has always been a joke because everybody didn't land. It's still not an international airport as far as I'm concerned, but that's what they called it. So we all went out there, and KDKA had a line hooked up on its TV show, and they interviewed every representative there. Most of them, all of them, they asked, does Air France plan to land in Pittsburgh? Does British Airports plan to land in Pittsburgh? Does this one, that one? When they came to me, they didn't ask me that. They said, can you describe El Al security? Well, to say that I swallowed hard and nearly died with the cameras grinding, you know, I'm the kind of person that always thinks of the right answer a week later. You know, I think that's a human frailty. Yeah. But to this day, I can only tell you the gentleman upstairs was watching and took pity on me. I cannot take credit for my answer. So I said, describe El Al security. Well, if I describe El Al security, we will no longer have it. And everybody laughed. And then he said, well, can you at least tell us how do people react to the security? I said, oh, I'll be very happy to tell you that. You see, when the man in front of you and the woman behind you all get the same going over, and everybody's bag is searched the same way, and the same question is asked of each one, you would be upset if they didn't do the same thing with you. So security is no problem. Just sometimes makes the plane late, that kind of thing. I said, but basically, people enjoy and respect our security. And yes, I do think it's the best in the world.
Yes, Bill, as you were growing up, adolescent years, you've given us some very serious aspects of your life. What about fun and games?
Well, first of all, I have to go back to something which happened when I was around, I think I was 9 or 10 years old. I don't remember which. I came down with rheumatic fever and something called chorea. And in those days, the treatment was different than it would be today. I'm sure I was in bed for a whole year. I had to learn to entertain myself. I did all kinds of crazy things. And the doctors had told my mother I would always be frail, I would never have children, I would die all the way up and down the line, and I fooled them all, of course. But a little of this followed me through my whole adolescence. For instance, I never learned to swim. I hated that. I was stopped from playing tennis. I hated that. So what do you do? As a child, I did a lot of writing. I think I was all of 15 years old when I wrote something about the Sphinx, how I looked on his face and he didn't tell me, meaning he didn't tell me the history of Egypt. All kinds, because my imagination ran wild through those years, and that took its place. But when I was about 18, I think, I had written several little plays. One, this is very funny, and there were 6 prizes. I came in third place, something called Lady Goes Charming or some darn thing, I don't know. And Walt Framer, who you remember, came in fourth after mine. So these were really very, very funny things.
Of side 1, take 4, continued on side 2.